Olá, senhoras e senhores, bem-vindo a mais um Criativo Cast. Hoje estamos aqui com um convidado super especial que veio de longe para conversar com a gente, mas para aqueles amantes do desenvolvimento de game, com game design, vai adorar esse papo, porque é um papo com o papa da matéria. Então, hoje a gente vai conversar com o Grant Schunkweiler. Is that right?
Yep.
Did I say it right?
Perfect.
E eu vou falar em inglês, porque ele só fala inglês e vocês acompanham aí através da legenda para aqueles que ainda não falam inglês. Welcome, Grant. Thank you for sharing a little bit of your knowledge here with us. It's a pleasure to have you here at the Creative Cast with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So, Grant, not a lot of people knows the whole development of game, and I want you to tell us a little bit how you started, how did you get, up to this point, what's the path you had to go through to get where you are now?
Yeah, so everybody's path is different into game development. Mine is really weird. It starts out traditionally, and then it just gets a little different from there. But I started making games when I was 12 years old. I started just by modding games and writing my own versions of games, thinking I could make better games than the people who were doing it professionally. Turns out I couldn't, and I probably still can't, to be honest. So I started making games at a young age, and then kind of took a diversion and started doing a lot of music and live show production. And through that I found Full Sail University, which is where I went to learn how to make games professionally. Mm-hmm. And I graduated from there and got my first job as a game programmer. And then from there, my career gets a little weird. So I started as a game programmer and started talking at the company I was at with the creative director, the person who's in charge of the design of games. And eventually became a designer, and then eventually was lead designer, kind of helping run production for all the games, coming up with all the ideas with the creative director. And then from there I left and became a technical producer, which means I was a producer focused on programming and programmers and the technical aspects of games. Then became a producer, which meant I kind of managed people, project management, dealt with different people on the project, made sure everybody had what they needed, and kind of had that different companies for a few years, and then left the AAA space to start my own consulting and contracting company.
Awesome.
And now I contract and do game design and game production and leadership.
Would you say that you most of the people start by programming, or it was just a coincidence that you started by programming?
I think for me it was just how I saw my path into the industry. Some people program, some people make art, some people go through quality assurance, which is testing. Everybody has their own different path and their own dreams. Some people just want to do one thing forever. For me, I wanted to try and do a lot of different things.
Yeah, because as you said, you did it all. The whole chain, you know.
Most of it. I can't make art. I've done a little audio, but I can't make art.
What makes you quite a unique professional is because you've seen from all the positions what it has to be done. So you have the authority to hire because you know what has to be done. Mm-hmm. And eventually you can do better than whoever you hired for. So I guess when you got to a producer, which means they put you in the right spot because you know how to do a little bit of everything. So you can, and I'm assuming you got a huge network of people that you work with. So it makes sense.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It makes sense to put you on that position towards where you are now.
Yeah. And that was kind of my overall goal, was to be in a position where I could help lead a team or a company. And I felt like the best way to do that was to become proficient, not necessarily become an expert at any of the skills, but
right.
be good at those skills so that I can
awesome.
Speak the language with the other creatives. Turns out I actually am pretty good at some of those things, which is why I still do them to this day. I'm not a super great programmer, so I don't code much.
But you used to, or no?
Yeah, I used to. Yeah. I used to. That was my first job.
When you coded, what kind of language did you code?
C++
C-sharp?
And C# were the two that I mostly coded in.
Is this still relevant?
Yeah.
Those two languages are the ones run the show.
They're pretty much the de facto for the game industry. There's other languages that are support languages, scripting languages, and things like that. But in general, C languages like C++ and C# are the main kind of workhorses.
So if someone that's watching us right now wants to get into coding games, that's what they should learn.
That's what I would recommend. Yeah. Probably start with C#. It's a little easier and safer. You're not like, is it? Kill your computer. C++ is really the most powerful, so you can destroy your own computer.
If you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I mean, even if you do know what you're doing, sometimes it's like, just goes off on its own and kills things. So.
Well, I've done a little bit of programming on the website.
Yeah.
And I start to manage some servers remotely, and I made a big mistake on a single character that I was supposed to be like this, and it was like that, and it just deleted my whole entire server.
That's all it takes. one little thing wrong, and you're like, done.
I see the screens like, deleting. No, how can I stop this? It was too late.
Too late. That's amazing.
So programming is something that you should really get, professional, because you can easily mess up not only games or computers or anything.
Yeah. It can be a bad outcome if you.
All right. So then you start programming. From programming, you start to designing. Did you say?
Yeah.
And when you mean design, is not really the artwork, but is actually what the game is all about. What kind of interactions do they make? How do they kill each other? What kind of explosions? Tell us, what is a game designer that's not involved in art directly?
Yeah, so game designers, there's a lot of different types of game designers. Mm-hmm.
It's a generic term, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a generic term. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different positions within the field. For me, I'm more of like a mechanics designer, which means I come up with how the game works. Maybe a little bit of story in there, but mostly like, the player does this, 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 and this to achieve this. That's kind of what I write. Uh-huh. But, there's a lot of other positions, people who are doing, economy, people who are building the levels, who are designing weapons, any number of things. I do some of those things. I don't really do a lot of level design. I do some of those things. Decently.
When you say level design, there's some games that was supposed to be never ending, or all of the games you're supposed to reach end at some point.
Some games are, what we call procedural. So the design is being done by the computer, but we have to give it the numbers, right, to be able to do that. And that takes a designer to understand what makes a fun experience and a fun space. So levels can be built procedurally by the computer, but we need to kind of teach the computer the right way to do that. In general, most games, have spaces that are designed by a person, where everything is, from the chairs, how the chairs are set up, to the combat spaces. Everything is handmade by somebody.
So basically, when you design, do you actually, I don't understand anything about games, so excuse me if it's too basic. So when you say design, you have the controller here. If you push a button forward, you tell a computer to, when the user does that, you should run the animation from frame 10 to frame 200 or something like that?
Yeah. So the programmers would do more of that, but we, game designers, kind of define how that feels. A computer can do 1 through 20, and it does it at the speed that we tell it, but maybe we want to make it go a little faster, a little slower, something that feels a little more natural, something that's more exaggerated, whatever it is we're trying to make the player feel. That's what we define.
Awesome.
So it's a lot of nitty gritty work and play testing and playing over and over again to see how you can make it fun.
Are you a player, or are you a designer, or you cannot be a designer while being a player?
I've met a few designers who aren't necessarily players, but you can't design a game without playing your game. You may be designing it for someone that isn't you, right? I may be designing a game for kids, and I'm not a kid.
Right.
But I'm a game player first and a game designer second. I've been playing games longer than I've been designing games.
Yeah.
But I probably spend more time designing games than I do playing games. Which is good, because I get paid for one and not the other.
That's interesting, because I see my son, we're going to talk about that in a bit, but he loves to play the games in a way that is his passion. When we talk to him about it, I say, hey, do you want to design games? He's like, no, I want to play the games. Because he doesn't know what design is involved. Yeah. I said, what about if you can play your own game? And he's like, can I do that, Dad? Because for him, it's kind of weird that someone actually designed this. Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
And he just loved game, man. Yeah. And there's professional players now, not only, you know, as esport is, it's getting famous and famous.
Yeah.
So people can make money by playing games. So it is a profession now, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it takes hard work though. You got to play a lot and practice. It's not just like sit down and play for an hour
for
each
fun,
day.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, I hope they still have fun, but yeah, I could never do that. I could never play games that way.
Yeah.
For me,
10, 12 hours a day.
Yeah. For me, I'm either enjoying it as a player, like the experience, or I am, you know, trying to learn from it. But I couldn't play, like, I don't play a lot of competitive, I'm not a super competitive person, so I don't play a lot of competitive games. I'll play them to learn them.
Right.
But I'm actually not very
good. So let's mention a few games which you've been involved in, and then we'll talk about a few of them. Tell us some of the games you've worked from the beginning of your career up to now.
Yeah, so I've worked on 65 shipped titles. I've worked on about 70 games in total, including, well, probably more than that now because I have 6 or 7 in development with clients. But I started making games for the bars. You can play games at a bar, touchscreen games, and then mobile games, games that are some people might know are called like Photo Hunt and Jackpot Corner, games like that. And then I moved into the bigger game space, AAA game space, and I worked on Rage, Doom, Doom 3, BFG, a little bit of time on Wolfenstein, and helped a little bit with The Evil Within. And then I went to Epic and I worked on Fortnite, helped a little bit with Paragon, and helped with the game Battlebreakers as well. So worked on quite a few games.
Quite a few.
Yeah.
Huge games, by the way.
Yeah. Some of them are huge. And, you know, I've just been lucky to get to help bring these dreams to fruition and help those teams.
Before we start recording, you mentioned to me a number of people involved in a game like that. And I was shocked, impressed. Tell us, in a game like Fortnite or any of those big boys like Doom, how many people is involved in a production like that?
Yeah. You know, it can be anywhere from like 50 to 200 at a time. In the span of the life of the game in development, it could be up to about 1,000 players or people. You know, some of the studios have even more. Some studios have up to 2,000 people helping on their games around the world. And sometimes that means that somebody just, you know, works on the game for 10 hours, 20 hours. And sometimes that means the person worked on it for 3 years.
That's what it takes, right? Yeah. How long does it take to create a game, a big game like that?
It depends. In general, most big games take about 3.5 to 4 years.
Wow.
But some games take longer. You know, there are games that take 9 years, 7 years.
Wow.
It just depends on how you're going through the process of making games. You know, a game like Fortnite went into early access, which meant we had 10,000 or so people playing it in December 2014, and then didn't have a commercial launch until the middle of 2017. But the game had been in development for years before that. So games have kind of changed in the way that we develop them. We do what we call betas and alphas, which means we get players involved at an earlier stage to give us feedback and help us make the game better.
That didn't exist back then, right?
No, there was a way that it existed, but we didn't really lean on it heavily starting until around like 2012-13.
Now is everything online. Old days, you have to buy the game on a cartridge and put that on a computer on a game console, and now it's such of an abundance of platforms. You got mobile, you got touchscreen, you got computers, you got consoles. I mean, you got everything.
Yep.
And how you design that? You design that with one platform in mind, or you design something that you can be played in multiple platforms?
It depends on the platform. So if you're making a game for like computers and for consoles, they're kind of designed similarly. But like a mobile game or a VR game would be designed in a way that is specific to the device, right? So I don't want a game that uses touchscreen controls to try and play the way that you would with a mouse and keyboard or with a controller. I want it to be designed in a way that is unique for that device. Mm-hmm. And same with virtual reality. Maybe you could play the game with a mouse and keyboard or controller, but in general, you want it to feel unique to that. So it really depends on the platform. But in general, like PC and console games are all kind of designed the same way. And then we just change the way that the player interfaces, you know, the controls.
Let's talk about virtual reality, as you mentioned. Do you believe virtual reality is something that's going to get mainstream somehow? Or because nowadays it's a little expensive. So we don't have a broad audience yet, as because people need to invest heavily on the device itself. Do you think that's going to change in the near future, or do you think that virtual reality is going to be like 3D TV, where it was a hype a couple years ago, now nobody talks about it anymore?
Yeah, I don't think VR is going to go away. I think that there's enough companies that aren't just game companies that are invested in virtual reality, and experiences, and helping people, be it medical or with you know, PTSD, things like that. I don't think it's going to go away. I think we have a couple problems that we need to solve, and you mentioned the first one, which is the cost.
Right.
But with all technology, cost goes down as time goes on. Yeah. Uh-huh. So the more people playing them, using them, the cost is going to go down, and then the quality of the device is going to get better. The second one is you look really dumb when you wear a VR headset, which is a big problem. In general, people don't like to look dumb when they do things. So that's the second thing that we kind of have to fix. So as the devices get smaller and more, more accessible, less expensive.
Are you designing anything for VR, or it's not your thing?
I have done some VR design, but I'm currently not working on anything for VR.
But do you like it? Is something that you're bullish on it, or
it's something really? I'm interested in. You do kind of have to think in a different way, a little bit different way. I'm not currently working with any clients that are doing virtual reality, because, like you said, the cost of entry is so expensive.
It is
that people are scared to go into the space because the amount of money that you can make is less than making a PC game or a console game.
What about mixed reality? Are you bullish on that?
Yeah, I really, I find mixed reality and alternate reality as well. I love that stuff. I find it super interesting, from games like Pokemon Go to, new experiences with like the Magic Leap one. I think that technology is really interesting. I think it also needs more time to advance and grow, especially wearables, because again, you look dumb.
Yeah.
Right? And they're really, really expensive. So once they get them to look like a pair of glasses, then I think people will really be into that.
Do you think? Because if you look at Google Glass, it was a big thing when they were about to release, and then after they released, it wasn't that successful, was it?
Yeah, because you look dumb. Yeah. Right? Like people made fun of you for wearing it. But that was kind of small, but it had a, I don't know, like it was a stigma, right? Like people made fun of people who wore it.
Right.
And I think that was the problem. I think if you were wearing glasses right now and I didn't know that they were AR glasses or mixed reality glasses, then I wouldn't like be like, you're wearing glasses, right? But when somebody was wearing a Google Glass, you're like, please stop recording me. Right. Like that was the main thing, is people were just like recording all the time. And I'm not a big fan of that.
Right. That's why it didn't work. But eventually, what mixed reality is going to be big, it was because the mobile device that is in the pocket of every single human being on Earth right now.
Yeah.
So in a way that everybody is able to have the experience, being a gamer or not. I'm not talking only about games, because game is pretty obvious, but there's a ton of other use for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why I'm pretty bullish on that. I think it's going to be huge.
Yeah,
right?
I think it's going to change the world.
Yeah.
I think it's going to change the way we interact with each other in the world.
Yeah, audio too. It's something that I'm very bullish about. This AI stuff, just Google AI is going so fast and it's learning such an incredible pace that I'm bullish on that too. I think it's going to be huge. Very soon we're going to be using voice and mixed reality for everything.
Yeah.
I don't know you, but I already use, I don't longer touch my phone to do anything. I talk to my phone.
Yeah.
And
it's a little scary.
It is. Very scary. How are your social media today? Are you a big, do you use that social media to put your games, to put your artwork on it, or you're not much on it?
For me personally, I'm you know, I don't really use like Twitter or Instagram that much. I have a Twitter more just to kind of read what people are posting. I have a Facebook page, which I kind of do a lot of my businessy things through, and LinkedIn. I think it's important to be discoverable.
Good.
But my clients with their games, you know, I encourage them to use all the social platforms, because the more ways people can find out about your games, the more ways they can buy your games.
Right, right.
And the more ways you make money, right? So for me personally, I try and limit my social media use because it's so addicting and limits your life.
Very true.
But I have to agree. But I do use it for...
Responsibly.
Know, yeah, I use it responsibly. I use it as part of my business, right?
Right, that's awesome. And before we start recording, we're talking about the fact that me and you, you and your game, and me as an audio video professional, that we try to use our creativity to make our a living. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
So, me, I start to putting like videos together and audio visual work, and you tell a story through the game. Yeah. So, for those that are watching us, give them a piece of advice. If you into games or creative industry in general, believe in yourself, go 100% and start making it, right? Yeah. Don't wait for someone knocking your door. Say, hey, do you want to work for me and create a beautiful piece of art? It ain't going to happen.
Yeah.
So just start doing it, right?
Yeah.
Tell us about it.
Yeah, I always tell people, if you want to make games, make games.
Good.
There's no reason to not. You know, if you don't have the skills, then learn the skills and then make games. They're going to be terrible for a long time and then maybe they'll be good. You know, I've made a lot of games.
Yeah.
A lot of those games weren't great. A lot of those games most people will never, ever hear about. And, you know, just I've been lucky to be part of the teams that have worked on some, you know, massive games. But you just got to make games and you got to, start failing quickly. You know, you have to,
that's a good point,
get into it and just start, you know, putting yourself out there and understanding that a failure is not the end result, that you can learn from your failures and grow from your failures.
Would you say that you have to have lots of failures in your life to achieve success or greater stuff?
Yeah. I definitely think that that's true. I mean, if I walk through any of the games that I've worked on that are successful, I can point to all the failures that we had to get to that point. You know, games take a long time to make because it takes a long time to find what's fun. And then once you figure that out, then you have to build the rest of the game around that funness. And it's important that you're comfortable as a company and as a studio with failure, and that it's part of something you celebrate as a studio. Oh, we failed, but we learned this. Okay, let's move on to the next thing. I think that's super important. You know, the other thing that I always tell people is like, you have to be curious. If you want to work in the creative space, you have to be a curious person because we're all trying to tell stories with our art. And if you're not curious about the world, then you're going to run out of stories. You know, you may have a story about your life that you want to tell, but what do you tell once you've told that story? I think people who are fundamentally curious never run out of things to talk about. I consider my curiosity one of my best strengths. And I think that...
Interesting.
I think that most people who are successful, like world-changing successes, right? Like Leonardo da Vinci,
right.
Marie Curie, you know, the Wright brothers, whoever it may be, people who have invented things that have changed the world, were fundamentally curious about something. And then they became a little bit obsessive about that thing. Me, I'm really curious about the world around me, and I'm constantly taking not good photos with my cell phone just to remember to look things up and understand why. You know, I love traveling. I've loved my time here in Brazil because I just keep seeing things and I take a picture and then I go back to the hotel and I'm like, why is this a thing here? You know? And I ask people that live here, I'm like, why did you do things this way? Why are things this way? You know, like, why is your wire management so bad in your country? You know, like how many of those wires are actually live? Things like that. You know, you never know what's going to inspire you. For example, I was walking around the park here on Sunday and I saw some trees that I found really inspiring and went and kind of did some research on those trees. And then went and talked to a team that I'm working with about making sure that we have trees that look like that in the game that we're working on. Because I think that those trees tell a story, you know, and I think that very few players will sit and look at those trees and think about the story that they're telling. But
true.
But it adds to the overall set piece of the story that we're trying to tell.
So are you saying that the trees you found in the park was different than the trees you used to have where you live or where you work? They're different?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I'm from North America and I'm in South America.
A lot
America,
north, right.
And the trees that you have here are very different. Now, the one trees that I'm obsessed with and I've been obsessed with for years that are in the Southern Hemisphere are banyan trees. And you have those here as well as, you know, they have them in Hawaii and Australia and New Zealand and stuff. And I love those trees because they're just so unique in the way they grow.
So you let's try to put that into context and bring the tree to a game.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I'm trying to go back here, reverse engineering the process of game design. So you like that. You love to add that particular trees to your mm-hmm. to your game. What do? You take pictures sent to your crew?
Yeah, so what
do they replicate it in 3D?
Yeah, so what I actually did, because I'm working on a game that takes place in Hawaii and I spent some time there and I had a bunch of reference photos,
right.
And the people I'm working on have some as well. And I just was kind of walking through the space the other day in the game after I had walked through the space of the park. And I started kind of comparing some of the pictures I have and thinking about, oh, well, I've seen this in Hawaii and that in Hawaii. So what I would do is I would take a bunch of reference photos and then find some online, right? There's better pictures with better cameras than my cell phone.
Got it.
I'll put a list together of what kind of things are important of a banyan tree, or we'll just use a banyan tree as an example, right? The way that the vines come down and then form and spiral into each other and then go into the ground and then eventually turn into a root system or a branch system is what's important to the tree. So I took a lot of pictures of that up close because I didn't find a lot of those online. And then I'll send those to a 3D modeler who will then build out a basic kind of tree that looks like that and then have some different variations so that we don't have the same tree a hundred times in the game. Uh-huh. And then for this game, we have a foliage system. The tree system is procedural. So we will then add that to the list of procedural trees. And a programmer and designer will go in and define what that tree would look like in a space, right? So a tree can't be inside of another tree. It has a space around it that it needs. Its root system would be like this.
Awesome.
And they put all that information in. And now when we regenerate all the trees in the map, there will be banyan trees.
That is awesome. And then, but you do that all, they do it in a low poly kind of situation, right? For game.
Well,
you
don't do high like poly and then low poly.
Oh, they do both?
Yeah.
So I was guessing you would, let's say you like a particular tree.
Yeah.
You would do like a point cloud of that tree. Mm-hmm. And then you bring that into a software to do the mesh, to do very photorealistic out of the real tree.
Yeah.
And then you make a low poly out of that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty much how we do it. So we do a high poly and a low poly, and the low poly makes the high poly makes the materials and the textures. So we actually put high poly materials and textures on a lower poly thing. So it's more performant, but as a user, you wouldn't be able to tell that because the skin of the tree, right?
The texture is just as high as
it looks high, right? But it's
the poly is low.
Poly is low. So
awesome.
Yeah.
That is great.
Video games are smoke and mirrors.
That is great. And then I'm looking at, I don't know anything about games, but I do know a lot about 3D rendering.
Yeah.
And sometimes this is very cartoonish, but some of the photorealistic ones, it takes forever and ever to render.
Yeah.
And video game got this power to render that in real time. And I think that is amazing for us that is in the film business to look at some of this stuff and say, how the hell do they do that in real time?
Yeah. I mean, the main thing for us over film is like we understand that things don't have to be perfect because we're at 60 frames per second. We're moving quickly through the space. Players aren't like viewers. They don't just look at a screen for a set amount of time, right? So I don't know, we'll use Moana as an example, right? In Moana, there's like a scene happening on the water, and she's in her ship, and the camera's just kind of there for like a minute and a half. you are looking at that and you're looking at everything happening. So everything has to be pixel perfect in that scene. In games, we don't necessarily worry about pixel perfection because you're moving quickly. We're at a higher refresh rate. You're kind of going through the space in a different way. And as a gamer, you're always like looking all around you. You're not just looking at that space and at that image. So we just smoke and mirrors everything, right? If something's on screen, we're rendering it. As soon as something goes behind you, it's gone. It may still be there in a computation sense, but visually it's not being rendered anymore. We call that occlusion. So everything behind you doesn't exist, which is also weirdly part of quantum mechanics, theoretically. In quantum mechanics, nothing behind you exists.
Exactly. But does it mean that you sometimes doing a game that it gets too much for the computer or to the console to process? Do you have to rethink about it, how you're going to present the game? Because it's too complex for the computer to process.
Yeah. Performance is a big part of it. You know, sometimes you limit the number of players or you limit the number of AI on screen or number of polys.
When you say you AI on screen, sorry, for what's that exactly?
Yeah. So for example, here in the shot, you know, there's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 bad guys.
Okay.
Now there may be a rule. I don't remember off the top of my head for Rage, but there may have been a rule that said like we could only have 7 bad guys on screen at one time, because when an AI is active on screen, we're not only rendering all of their polys, their textures, their materials, but any effects that might be coming with them, as well as computing their behaviors.
You have ambient inclusion there. You got all kinds of heavy stuff.
Yeah, this is an old game, 2011, but it was, from a technical visual standpoint, it was very, very advanced.
Very, even today, if you think about it, looks very good.
Yeah. That one over there is the same engine, just, 5 years later, so...
Is that the same game, just a new version?
No, so this is Rage, and that's Doom.
Doom.
One you fight demons, and one you fight mutants. Both you have shotguns. That one's a shotgun, actually. That's an AK.
So does the majority of the games kind of follow a specific predefined kind of look? Let's say game, shoot people, or shoot whatever, creatures. Then you got the cars, then you got can we create new games that has never been done before, or we're just gonna make games that is a little different than what has been done a couple years ago?
I think I hope, and it's part of what I do now, is that we're bringing things into the space that have never been done before.
Is that possible?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's possible. I think what's interesting is games are a lot like film, right? So you're always going to have Marvel films because they make a lot of money. You're always going to have games with guns because they make a lot of money. But you can have these indie films that are telling stories in a different and interesting way. You can have indie games doing the same thing. So they're doing mechanics in a new way. They're doing storytelling in new ways. So there's new game types coming up all the time. And, you know, these indie game developers that don't have hundreds of people are working on these really interesting, weird mechanics, and they're kind of on the forefront helping us find new things so that all the developers can make new stuff.
Can those guys make real money, serious money, or the money is on the hands of the big companies?
They make pretty serious money.
The independent ones?
Yeah, I think not all of them, right? Like, if out of every 200 indie games, probably 2 of them are real money successful. Probably 50 pay for themselves. They pay back the money that it costs them.
So the majority doesn't even pay for themselves.
Yeah. That's just because there's a lot of them.
A lot of people doing it.
Yeah, there's a lot of people doing it now, and their games aren't good.
Oh, I see.
But they're going to get good.
That's the thing. That's what we're talking in the beginning. I mean, to get good, you got to do the bad stuff first.
Yeah, and understand that, you know, your first game may not be a million-dollar hit, you know?
And it's funny that you say that, because you're coming from games, but there's a lot of people that said the same thing from any industry. Yeah. If you're doing a movie and your first movie, you don't feel sick by watching it, something is wrong.
Yeah.
Because you're supposed to fail in the first movies you've done because you're learning in a way, right?
Yeah.
You're learning and you're failing and you're learning from your fails, and that's what makes you great in a way.
Right, yeah.
The repetition. As a matter of fact, there's people saying that you got to spend 10,000 hours in whatever you're doing to become a master on it.
Yeah.
So 10,000 hours is a lot of hours.
That is a lot of hours.
So you really got to love it. You know, it comes back to what do you love doing it? Because you have to be doing this for a long period of time if you want to get good at it. So if you don't love it, don't even start, because you're going to burn very quickly.
Yep.
Do what you love, then you can do for the rest of your life, and you're not going to feel it. You're going to be like, hey, is that right? I'm getting paid for that? For real?
There are days that it'll feel like work, and you'll be like, why am I doing this? Exactly. But you may try and quit, right? You may take a break, and then you'll come right back to it. That's what I found. If you do something that you love, you can't stop doing it, right? Like, I took a break from making games, and I came back. Right. Uh-huh. Because I love it. And, you know, I am good at it, but I love it. And, it's my passion. And so for me, I couldn't stay away.
Good. That's the way it should be.
Yeah.
That's how you prove that you love it. Otherwise it would be like, I loved for a little bit. Now I don't love it anymore.
Yeah. But there are days that it just feels like work. You know, I think, I've never had a job where I'm like, every day I'm like, at some point, this needs to start feeling like work. Every game I've worked on, there have been days where I'm like, this is work. You know, this is hard. We're slogging through this. But in general, the amazing days outweigh those days.
So if you're in America, which has a very strong market, very strong consumption market, which whatever you put out, you end up selling it. In Brazil, it's a little different. Do you believe that the guy that wants to start doing games, to do it globally already, do it thinking worldwide, do it thinking that your audience could be 6 billion people.
Yeah.
Don't do it for Brazil, because if you're doing only in Portuguese, you're not going to sell it. If you sell it, you're going to sell a very low amount. So every time you're doing a game, you're already thinking globally?
Yeah. Not only do we make games globally, but we sell them globally. You know, I think if you're thinking that your game is a local game that's only going to sell in your region or your town or your city or your country, then you're limiting your audience. And not only that, but you're limiting your story, right? Like, if you're making, say you're making a game that's traditional for Brazilians in Brazil, right? I want to play that. I want to know that. I want to know what's unique and interesting about that. That's different.
Well, it's easy to say, because you do the games in English, and I'd say the great majority. Well, I won't say great majority. The great majority of people speak Mandarin, which is Chinese.
Yeah.
But only in China, I toured the world, and I could speak English anywhere in the world. Which means if you do a game in English, the game itself doesn't have any language on it. But you got to go to menus. You got to choose weapons.
Yeah.
So when you do that, you do all in English, or when you do the game, you do multiple languages?
So we always start in English, and then we translate things. So we hire translators to translate things. We start with what's called EFIGS, which is English, French, Italian, German, and Spanish. And then we go from there. So we identify markets where we think we can be successful and start to translate for those regions, right? So in general, what you would do is kind of that EFIGS group, and then you would probably go to Russia, and then Brazil is an up-and-coming market, so you'd probably go to China and then Brazil, and you just start to add more.
Did you say Brazil what?
Brazil is an up-and-coming market.
Is it?
So Brazil is recovering from their sins, I think is the best way to put this. So piracy is what defined game development and game consumption in Brazil for...
Yes. Yes.
All of its existence in here.
But I don't blame them, and I'll tell you why. Cost of not only buying it, but the amount of duties and taxes they put on top of it is ridiculous. It's outrageous.
Yeah.
So basically, the population had no other options but piracy.
Me, as an American developer, this is kind of a mean thing to say, but I don't care why people pirated games, right? There's no money for me to be made in that space, so I'm not going to work in that space. And then recently that's changed, right? Because we can offer games for free. And now anybody, the barrier for entry into the game is much smaller because it doesn't cost 2,000 reais or whatever, right? It's not,
it's free.
It's not someone's monthly income to play the game. It's free.
That is awesome.
And so, yeah, so that's
that is amazing.
That's how we're trying to, that's why, you know, I say Brazil is like an up and coming market, as well as, you know, just the cost of games is cheaper here. Just because, like you said, the taxes and things like that. So people are starting to focus on Brazil as an up and coming market.
And I'm happy for that.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that is the other problem that has happened is it has stunted the growth of the industry here. Because people don't want to stay here to make games, right? And all the people that I know that are Brazilian who make games in the United States because they didn't see the market existing here for them to make games because they would just get pirated, right? So now that the way that games make money is shifting and the cost of playing games is dropping, it just makes sense that a population the size of Brazil's would be an up-and-coming market.
Yeah, 200 million people. So it's not as big as China or even U.S., but there's a lot of people in this country.
It's huge. Right?
São Paulo alone got, I don't know, 25 million people.
Yeah, it's like the fourth largest city in the world.
It's just like if you grow a little bit more, you're bigger than Canada.
Yeah.
Population-wise.
Yeah, it's insane.
So
yeah,
it's a big market. It's just that the majority of the people don't have the money.
Yeah.
So the fact that it's free and a lot of people got mobile devices here. So it's going to grow exponentially.
Yeah. I think Brazil is right on the cusp. It's ready to kind of explode in popularity, both in games being made here and games being sold here. And
there's
that's
some,
exciting for me.
Some engines are free too, right?
Yeah. Yeah. They're free up to a point, right? So Unreal Engine, for example, which is what Epic made Fortnite in is free to play or free to use. And then you pay a percentage of money on your revenue once it reaches an amount, right? So you pay them like 5% once it reaches $10,000 or something. I'm not sure what the exact things are now. But
the other engine is free too, right?
Yeah, Unity you can use a student license, but once you want to make money
you also have to pay.
But that doesn't matter, right? Because at that point you're a company, but the main thing is it's, you know, democratizing game development, right? Anybody can get
anybody can use those building. Engines for free.
Yeah. Everybody can make games.
That's
technical.
The point.
It's hard, but like that's what's important to me is that everybody can make games, right?
Awesome.
Like it doesn't matter if you end up doing it, but if you have the opportunity to do it, that's what's important.
That is awesome. And I think I emphasize here that I want you to do that. I want you to start, if you like it, start, download it. It's free. Yeah. There's no barrier. Again, as he said, it doesn't matter if it's bad, the first one. Yeah. It's good if it's bad because you're going to learn from it.
Yep.
The number 20 or 25 is going to be the greatest.
Yeah.
And I'm not a game designer, but I've been talking to so many game designers that I'm curious myself. I'm serious.
That's awesome.
I'm curious myself. I might download a unit myself and start playing it because I love technology.
Awesome.
I love people. And I love the fact that people get addicted in a way to games.
Yeah.
So it must be interesting. So I want to get to learn more, even
That's
though I
awesome.
Have... nothing to do with programming. I don't know how to program anything.
Yeah.
But I just learned with you and with my previous people that talked to me that you don't have to know all that.
Yeah, you don't.
Right? You have to have friends.
Yeah, yeah.
Which you can put together as a team, just like a rock band.
Yep.
You know,
just
everybody
like
play the instrument. And that's how you, it's a collab, just like film, right?
Yep, collaborative.
You collaborate with people, 100%.
Yeah.
Does any game has been done by one person 100%? Rarely.
I'm sure there has been.
It has been.
But
not big ones.
But not, you know, they may make the game 100%, but they're not like marketing the game and selling the game by themselves, right?
So you need a team.
You need people.
You need
people.
Like, just like film or anything else. Anything on a creative industry.
You need people. You need support. And even them, right? Even if there was a person who made a game 100% by themselves, they had someone who supported them through that process, right? A friend, a family member, a loved one, whatever it might be. There was someone who supported them when it got hard. So I don't think anybody makes anything by themselves. I don't think anybody makes any
creative work by themselves. I agree with you 100%. Now, to finalize that talk, I would like you to talk directly to whoever was watching us and tell a last message. You know, if they're bullish about game design, if they want to get involved, what should they do? Do it.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So step one, make games. Step two, make games. you know, I think it's really important that you find the best way for you to learn how to make games. That may be to go to university. That may be tutorials online, whatever it is. But you have to understand, without failure, you'll never have success. If you don't take risks and put yourself out there, you'll never have success. If you don't surround yourself with good people who are passionate about what they're doing, again, you'll never have success. There's a lot of things that you have to do to be successful, but none of that happens if you don't start trying. And that is for all creatives, not just the game industry. And the awesome thing is, look, we have the internet. And so if you want to learn how to do anything, you just type it into Google and you're going to find a free tutorial. So, you know, my final thing is just go out there and make things
and do it.
Just do it.
No excuse now. Google made everything easy. Google and YouTube made everything.
Seriously.
It's true though. It's 100% true. So thank you, Grant. Problem. It was a pleasure to have you. And I won't, hopefully you're going to be back to Brazil soon.
Yeah, I hope so too.
And you're already invited to come back. We can continue this talk and eventually have time to have a beer. I don't know if you drink beer or not, because you're being worked since you got to Brazil. Didn't stop.
Non-stop.
So hopefully next time you get some time off and we get some time to have a cold beer. And it was awesome to talk to
Thanks
you.
For having
it was
me.
A pleasure, and I'll see you next time.
All right. Sounds good.
Thank you. Bye.